I'm doing a PhD here at the University of Glasgow in the Department of Education, and I'm looking at assessment of service learning. And in my travels, I found three exemplary scholars who I thought are looking at, when we were in Jane's session yesterday, and she talked about the three different levels, the instrumental and the communicative and the emancipatory, I found in these academic staff this emancipatory vision of what education could be. And service learning is on that edge of the university and the community, where the students go into the community in a situation of doing service, but also of doing academic credit. And so there's a lot of that community engagement, and there's a lot of different things going on, a lot of different goals being met. And the assessment of this, I think, is an added, almost, I don't want to really say the word burden, but it's this another task that academic staff need to think about and need to take on in their work, which I find very, very interesting. And these three, I'm going to introduce each of them, and then I'll give you, just before they speak, I'll give you a little more information. And so this is Fiona Patrick, and she's at the University of Glasgow here in the School of Education. Avril Bellinger, who is at the University of Plymouth in the School of Social Work. And Janet Strivens, who is at the University of Liverpool in the Teaching and Learning Center. And I think we're going to start with Janet.
No, Avril.
Avril? Okay, thanks. So Avril is associate professor and senior lecturer at School of Social Science and Social Work, University of Plymouth. Avril's expertise includes her current roles as Social Work Practice Learning Coordinator, core member of the Center for Excellence in Professional Placement Learning, and fellow of the Center for Sustainable Futures. She is also the chair and founder of Students and Refugees Together, the START program. And I think envisioner of that program. I think that was, yes, very. She has an interest in supporting communities through good social work placements and practice, and is concerned that recent changes in assessment protocols may be detrimental to the students, the profession, and the communities themselves.
I'm going to try to stick to the more or less the text that you put in front of you, because otherwise I'll take the hour and a half you've got and you won't be able to hear from anybody and you won't be able to ask questions, because I'm hoping this will be a conversation rather than a one-way traffic. How many people are familiar with social work education? Social work education, about the how it works and the requirements for it a bit. Yeah, okay. So I'm going to kind of do some basic stuff around it. And I'm very happy to talk much more about the START program, Students and Refugees Together, if that's what you're interested in. But my brief, I think, today has been about assessment of service learning. And so that's what the focus of this will be. Happy to diverge later, if you want to. One of the things I want to get really strongly clear about, though, is that we've had a lot of talk about the big society, about reducing resources, about how I went home yesterday and was really distressed to have sat in rooms with people who've either lost their jobs or were losing their jobs or were making staff redundant at a time when we're supposed to be building capacity in communities and of the people who have the least. And I think that tells us where there's massive gap is between the rhetoric and the reality. And I don't want to pretend we're anywhere else here, because I think social work is about intervening in that space. It's not about doing the government's bidding, removing children in a process that's called child protection. That social work is something that's much bigger than that. It's an excellent book by Michael Lavalette at the moment, talking about social work in extremis, and it's drawing on what social work can be in decimated communities, and it's got some really interesting lessons in there. So I'll get back on line there on Messi. So, if you're not familiar with social work qualifying programs, service learning is built in. It's an absolute requirement. Currently, students have to do 200 days of what's called gaining required experience and learning in practice settings. And that has to be a variety of practice settings. And they have to be assessed at the end of that by someone who's a qualified social worker. Unfortunately, the previous kind of infrastructure for teaching and assessing students in practice learning has completely disappeared. So it used to be a specialist activity that you were trained and assessed for. And now, as you can hear, if you're a social worker, you can do it at the end. And if you're anybody else, you can do it earlier on. So I'd like to invite you to assess social work students. That's what the regulations permit. It's not what we permit at Plymouth, I have to say. So students must do, we have two programmes at Plymouth. One is the postgraduate Masters in Social Work, and that's a 2-year programme. Practice learning is 65 days in the first year and 135 in the second year. We have a BA in Social Work, that's a 3-year programme, 40 days in the first year, 60 days in the second and 100 days in the third. And in the first year, students are spread amongst 3 different settings, 10 days in statutory observation, so they can see what happens in those settings, 15 days in what we call community development projects, so small groups of students go out and undertake projects that agencies have said they want doing. And that could be almost anything that a small agency asks for. And 15 days doing what we call social care work experience, where they have to roll up their sleeves and go out and do something useful with people who need volunteering, kind of befriending services. So they're out there doing, they've come because they want to make a difference, so we give them that opportunity as soon as they come. Some of our most recent social care work experiences are actually alongside service users directly, and those service users are the supervisors of the students, so it kind of reverses those power relationships. It's a really exciting project. All practice learning attracts academic credit, so it's not something they just have to pass or fail, they are marked on it. And when I come to those processes of how we assess it, we'll return to those principles. What we are faced with in social work education is a kind of conflict between, you won't have missed the Social Work Task Force, the Reform Board, requirements to review and change the way all of social work is trained for, practiced, overseen, regulated, and even the setting up of a separate professional college to oversee the profession. So there are humongous changes happening at the moment in social work and social work education. There's a lot of pressure to fit into state agendas, and what's very interesting is that the best placements, if you like, are seen as being within local authority statutory fieldwork teams, so children and families, child protection teams, those are seen as the real social work placements. And what's interesting is that the resources for those are going down and down and down. So, and I'm very interested in the kind of the politics that result in the universities getting the blame for there being no placements in a shrinking practice environment. It's a really interesting process that's happening. So locally, in keeping with a national trend, our placements have reduced from 75% in the statutory sector to 50%. Graduate destinations nationally are reducing from 90-something percent to currently it's about 60%. So our graduates are employable in a much wider field than in state services. And that's a very exciting potential, I think, for us. Which means that we shouldn't be driven by the kind of structures and requirements what are currently the national occupational standards and a kind of competence frameworks, current capabilities framework that's coming out. I think, how am I doing? I've got time on.
Yes, you've got 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. I'll save the rest of the politics for later. I'll just talk to you then about how we see practice learning as being about not just going out and learning through an apprenticeship model. We think learning in practice is very much more around building a community of practice, which Lave and Wenger described, where students are part of a community of people who are determined to do something better and more emancipatory than is currently being done. And I think the exciting thing about students is that they bring fresh ideas, they bring fresh perspectives. I don't know if you were here at the McNair presentation yesterday, but those young people are going to change the world. You know, it will be a different kind of possibility if students are allowed to bring their creative potential into workplaces where people are anxious about their jobs, where they're depressed about a reduction in services. Students don't know what you can't do, and therefore they achieve and suggest quite impossible things. And an example of that is the organisation that I'm chair of, which is called START. It was set up 10 years ago. We had three very brave social work students at a time when people seeking asylum were being dispersed to Plymouth, and that was a very hostile host environment for people to come to. And so a social work programme, we tried to intervene helpfully in that. Social work students undertook became a virtual organisation. They went out and worked with people who were dispersed to Plymouth and made such a difference that we were able eventually to get big lottery funding, subsequently a government contract to provide refugee housing support. And that organisation now offers multidisciplinary placements to about 20 students a year using a staff of three. An administrator and two supervisors. So it's a kind of social enterprise model of how to use student capacity in community service. The assessment of student learning therefore becomes quite problematic. Is it what they achieve in the community? Is that what you're assessing? You know, are we concerned with how many people are become able to make their homes in Plymouth securely and their children settle into the community? Is that what we're measuring? Are we measuring the satisfaction of the organisation with the students? Are they doing the things they're supposed to be doing within the agency, filling in the forms, doing the bits of paper? Are they meeting our educational agendas? You know, what are those things? And oftentimes I'm asked, so is START a university thing? Is it for the students, or is it a service agency? And that's where I think binaries are really unhelpful, because it's everything and actually maintaining those tensions between those agendas equally is a kind of constant business. So not falling into a kind of tidy, simple framework of that it's a this, or it's a this, or it's a that, and I can tick the box. So how do we assess student learning? A whole variety of ways. And this is across both the programmes now. We use blogs, so students are required once a fortnight to blog on a secure site that all the students and the relevant staff can see about something that's happened in their practice learning. So they've got to think about confidentiality, they've got to use their learning, their academic learning, and reference those blogs, as well as talking about what they're feeling about it. So it's kind of academic, critical, analytical, and it's concurrent as they're going through. Some of those form part of what they hand in for a mark at the end. All students undertake what we call practice observations, so somebody qualified comes in and watches them working with a service user or carer in situ. Students don't just go into that as kind of victims, if you like, to be inspected. They have to prepare, they have to say what they're doing, why they're doing that, how they understand what they're doing in a written format. That goes to their observer. After the observation, after a debrief, the student then writes up a self-assessment. Did I do what I thought I was going to do? So the emphasis on kind of self-evaluation, self-critical skills. And then the observer tells them how accurate that self-assessment is. They don't kind of repeat the observation process. We put a high prize on things like service user and carer feedback, and those are collected both by students and by other people that form part of documentation that we see. Most students have a site supervisor or somebody who gives them their day-to-day work who's not necessarily a social worker or a practice educator. We ask them for their feedback about what the student's done and how they've done it. Student summary of work undertaken, and the student has to bring together a critically analytical, reflective self-assessment of what they've done. And I think the difficulties, some of the problems we encounter with that sort of assessment is people say, so what sort of weight do you give to what the student writes and what weight do you give to what other people write? Automatically putting in a divide. And we say we don't. Actually, it's read holistically. You read through those documents for a picture of the student as a thoughtful, reflective, knowledgeable practitioner. And you listen to all the voices, and no one voice is privileged. So you're looking across the whole scheme. In trying to ensure that subjectivity is reduced as much as possible, all work is marked independently by an academic and a practice teacher, neither of whom are involved with the student's work. So you're doing a text assessment of work. And then we have moderating panels where service users, carers, practitioners, academics, and practice teachers all read across the work and check up on the quality of what we're doing. So these are our attempts to kind of fend off the tick box, techno-bureaucratic kind of, have you done this, have you done that, which is a kind of constant, ongoing rebuilding the sandcastle every time the tide comes in, really.
Thank you. And now Dr. John Strumman is co-director of the Postgraduate Diploma Master's Program in Learning and Teaching in Higher Education and consultant at the Centre of Lifelong Learning at the University of Liverpool. Dr. Striven's current role reflects a range of interests from e-portfolios to the self-managed learner, as well as academic staff development and a special interest in all aspects of assessment.
Can you tell me when I've gone on for 10 minutes?
I can.
Okay, I may or may not stick closely to the text. I decided to write a very practical piece. And I want to sort of pick up bits of that. I thought I'd start, though, by giving you something of my context. I'm an educational developer, so I'm part of the central service there to support staff. That's my prime role in learning and teaching. And the institution I work in, it's important, I think, to understand something of the context. so you know where I'm coming from. It regards itself as a research-led institution. For UK people, you'll know what I mean when you say it's in the Russell Group, although some people might think it's hanging on in there by its fingertips. It's a civic university. From a widening participation point of view, however, it has a good reputation in that it's always attracted a higher proportion of students from state schools than most Russell Group universities, and it has a particularly good reputation for widening participation in terms of attracting local students from schools with no tradition of sending students into HE, first in family students and so on. And we've been monitoring those students. Very often they've received lower offers, and we find that they are outperforming other students who come in with regular qualifications. So we have a real interest in WP, which we need to kind of reconcile with what is in fact quite a traditional university with a wide range of very traditional subjects. And I'll just say something about the subjects in terms of what I want to say about assessing learning in the workplace. We have a strong health area, medicine, dentistry, vets, but also a range of professions allied to medicine. All those professions obviously have learning in the workplace as part of their requirements. We are pushing all sorts of other work-based opportunities, some for credit, but many for extracurricular purposes like volunteering, which is strong. And one thing I want to mention particularly, I think, is the Department of Sociology interchange program, where there is work-based learning for credit, but the idea of that is that you work with a community group to do some research that it needs doing and do two entirely separate pieces of assessment, one of which is a report back to the community to serve their purposes, and one of which is, if you like, a more academic piece. So there's a range of different contexts in which I have to support staff in helping students to learn in that context. But it would be disingenuous of me to say that the driver is about public engagement or service. It's not. From the university's point of view, the driver is the employability of our students. And then that is tempered, if you like, by the nature of the different disciplines that people work in. So I have to take that into account. My main driver, I suppose, and certainly what I've focused on in this presentation, is if you put students into a workplace, how do you ensure that they get the maximum out of it? And if you do have to assess that, and actually you have to assess it even if it isn't for credit, because if it's volunteering and goes on a student record, they want some kind of feedback that they can put on it. But certainly if you're assessing it for academic credit, Avril has already raised some of the issues of reliability, fairness, and I would want to add, especially after I've just heard her talk about how they do it, staff workload. I'm aware of all these issues. I am entirely committed to workplace learning as a good experience for the students, over and above any political commitments I may have to the value to the community. But I'm aware, I'm very conscious of why staff back off it. So, briefly, supporting students in getting the most out of a work-based placement. In other places, I've characterised workplaces as rich environments for learning, but chaotic. Obviously, the learning isn't packaged. It doesn't come at you in nice, neat order, appropriate to your level. So, two things. Students need to notice stuff. And sometimes they need to extract information which isn't obviously there. So there's a need for giving them guidance about how to notice stuff. And that pushes staff in the direction of structured questions, which seems to me to be entirely appropriate. And they need an ongoing record, because when they've experienced something, they may not immediately be able to analyse its significance. They may need to do that at leisure or later, or that the significance may dawn on them later. So, as Avril said, the learning log, the blog, whether paper or electronic, I'm in favour of electronic, but, you know, I'm aware that students in hospitals can't necessarily carry around, or, you know, there are NHS firewalls which bedevil our lives. Okay, I'm agnostic about that, but a regular record. And now I want to spend the rest of my time on how you overcome some of the problems, the assessment problems associated with that. And I've divided those into workload, issues around privacy, confidentiality, and this one about inter-rater reliability or consistency or fairness, how you want to call it, particularly if you involve workplace supervisors of any sort in that assessment process, which I personally think is very important. Okay, workload. I have a suggestion which I've put in the paper and given some examples on, of a mechanism by which a student summarises experience periodically to share, but is cross-referenced with a learning journal. Part of the idea being to make sure they keep the learning journal, but to avoid the tutor having to read it all. I'm not going to dwell on this. It's only one strategy, but I put it in more to show where I'm coming from, recognising these practical barriers to getting people to do this. I've given an example of it's not a SWOT analysis, it's a SWOB analysis, but which would be cross-referenced by the student, and that would be the document that would be shared by a tutor at a review. That also overcomes some of the privacy problems. I know some academic staff are, I think probably unnecessarily, but concerned that they're trying to get students to talk about their feelings and emotions, and what right have I got to read all that sort of thing. I could talk for hours about that particular issue, but I'll just raise it and drop it. And again, this might be a way around it. The student writes what they want, and would be expected to bring any log or have it accessible to a review meeting and be able to refer to it, but the tutor isn't necessarily expected to read everything. That might be a way of doing it. Getting any kind of consistency seems to me to be a huge issue in assessing reflective work across the board, and most of you will know there's a massive literature on developing reflective learning and assessing it. For me, one of the major issues is which criteria are you really using when you set a reflective task? I know there's a lot of stuff which I'm sympathetic to, like the Jenny Moon stuff, which looks at depth of reflection, and that reflective work needs to be analytical and critical, not just descriptive. I totally agree, but sometimes you need the description, and you need to actually, particularly for a novice reflector, a student at an early stage, make a clear distinction between description and analysis, and actually, if you like, separate. So writing the descriptive stuff is fine, especially if it's for them and they've got to read it. It's about capturing the learning in the moment, which not necessarily having to understand the significance of it straight away. So the structured questions you provide as a tutor could be looked at later in relation to this boring stuff about today I did this, this and this, I saw this, this and this. Okay. But I ran a series of workshops with another hat on. I'm a senior director of the Centre for Recording Achievement, which some of you may know of. I ran a series of reflections workshops a couple of years ago on supporting learning from reflection. And the tool we used for this was on your the back page of your handout, these criteria for assessing reflective writing. We got people to bring along examples of their writing that students have produced. We asked them to bring something they thought was a good piece and something they thought was a weak piece. And then for the good piece, we asked them to say, which of these criteria are you really addressing here? Don't choose more than three. And as we expected, what we found was, depending on their background, depending on the level of the student, they had different purposes for reflecting the, for assessing this reflective work, and therefore they'd pick on different ones of these criteria. And they'd add more. And one that they might add, and again I think this relates to what Avril was saying, right at the bottom, more than commitment to improvement or change is, have they actually achieved anything? So, you know, have those people in Plymouth actually, which is asking a hell of a lot from students, but, you know, how do you measure commitment to change? Whereas at the other end of the scale, you might very often be asking for accurate observations, linking the observations to stuff they've heard in their lectures, so making connections across things. In some areas, you might not be desperately interested in what their emotional reaction is to something. In others, it might be absolutely key. You know, we send computer science students out on work placement for their own good. Now, they're quite keen to do it. They go into local firms, small businesses, whatever, help them set up their websites, do all sorts of useful things. One of the things we're quite keen for them to learn in that is some business and commercial awareness. And you really have to direct students' attention to that if they're going to get it out, because they'll go into a small charity and say, well, this is a charity, so this, it's irrelevant. So it's probably not that important in that particular context that they look at their own feelings about the situation. I'm not saying it's completely irrelevant, but there may be other things that are more important. Academic staff are not clear about the criteria. They have a good instinct that getting students to write reflectively is the way to assess this kind of experience. You know, they're happy with the idea of the reflective journal, but they're really very unclear about what criteria they're really using. And if you don't have those criteria, I don't see how you can set up a moderating process that really, without a huge workload. I mean, I'm listening to what Avril said, there is this holistic process that your staff and your work-based supervisors are going through. And I'm thinking this is an excellent quality process, but what about the workload? So there's a practical streak in what I've tried to do, which is to say, can we achieve efficiencies by being clearer? And if I was training a group of work-based supervisors, which we typically do, say, with clinical tutors, on assessing the reflective work, I would want to be very clear and be using these criteria and take them through a kind of moderating process with sample student work in order to be confident about the fairness of the assessment if we're going to use it for credit.
Thank you. Thank you, Janet. We'll get back to some of those issues. And now I'd like to introduce Fiona Patrick. Dr. Patrick is a lecturer in professional learning and leadership and advisor of studies here at the University of Glasgow in the School of Education in the Faculty of Social
College of Social Sciences.
Okay. Are we a faculty anywhere?
No, we are colleges.
We got rid of faculty
together.
We don't
like faculties anymore. Yeah.
Her research interests include teacher professional development, professional identity, assessment and learning, teaching and learning in higher education.
And Gail took that from my web pages. She said to me, so I took it through, and I went, yeah, that's fine. And I've only realised that you can tell this is written for a Russell group. Her research interests are, if I say I'm a teacher, nobody in the university cares. If I say this is what I do research in, the university likes it. Yeah, it's funny talking about what I do. I'm a teacher. That's what I am. First and foremost, I do research, but I'm a teacher. And I teach on teacher education courses. And nobody really thinks of teacher education as service learning. And, well, very few. I've met very few that do. Especially not students. I work on undergraduate teacher education courses, but I'm going to talk today about the postgraduate teacher education course, and I'm going to talk about it when I led one of the elements on it. I don't lead that element anymore, and that element has radically changed. When I led what was known as the professional studies element, and I'll come back to that in a moment, the team and I who developed it were very keen to move students away from the concept of teaching as an apprenticeship model, where the placements that they did was everything. And the bit that we did, the academic, the theory bit, was, yeah, we'll turn up to the lectures, we'll write the essays, but hey, that's the academic stuff. Nobody really bothers about it because teaching's practical. It's about teaching a subject, and we'll do all our real learning in the placements in the schools. So the woman who ran it before me, Kathy Fagan, who's a really interesting lady, she's very committed to the whole idea of professional identity, had developed the professional studies element of the course to be much more focused on who are these people who are doing the teaching. How are you developing as a teacher? What are your ideas about teaching? So who is the person who teaches? As well as who are the people you're teaching? And what are the communities in which these children come from? It's about looking at the people you teach, the children you teach. What are their needs? So she'd done a lot of work to develop the element, and the team and I took that over and developed it further. And just to explain, the professional diploma in education takes students from across a range of subjects. There's a PGDE primary and secondary. We now teach the students together. It's a very intensive course. They're 9 months, in fact, they're less than 9 months in the university. They do 3 placement blocks, 6 weeks. And when the students come into us, they have been through education. They think they know what a teacher is. And it's mostly very practical. You teach a subject. Primary teachers will say, well, we teach a range of subjects, we teach children. Secondary teachers, we teach a subject. I'm an English teacher, I'm a maths teacher. And concepts of service and engagement to children, to parents, to communities, doesn't come into it. The school is seen as a little island on its own. It's not part of a community, initially. Some of them, if they go out into placements in schools who are more engaged with the community, they'll begin to shift. But it's the school. And worse than that, it's my classroom in the school. So it's very much focused on what goes on in the classroom. And yet, if you think about many of these students going in, particularly those who go into early years, this is the children's first experience of education. And look at what happens. By the time they get into upper primary, by the time they get halfway through primary, a lot of them are switching off to formal education. So that by the time they're in secondary, they're really switched off. Not all of them, but some of them. And by the time they're leaving secondary, some of them are lost to education. They feel they can't learn. They feel they're stupid. And they don't sit back and think, well, wait a minute, it's the system that's failed me. They think I'm the failure. And so for me, when I'm talking about what I do as a teacher educator, it's very much about helping students to see Yeah, you're not transferring a body of knowledge. You're partly doing that, but that's not what teaching's about. It's not the apprenticeship model. It's not about a craft or skill. The students very often come in with an assumption that as a teacher educator, what we're going to do is teach them a set of skills. If you go into a classroom and you do A and you do B, learning occurs. And it doesn't. And even in terms of the PGDE course itself, at the time I taught on it, and even still, the units of learning are compartmentalised. So they come to us for professional studies, and that's your theory, and that's your... And then they do the curriculum studies, and that's where you learn about what you teach. And then you go out onto placement, and that's where you really start being a teacher. And it's an apprenticeship model. And the professional studies element was very much about trying to encourage them to see it's not compartmentalist. It's trying to make them see the big picture and frame the big picture. It was very much about trying to get them to see there's no one effective way to teach. You can have as many models of effective teaching as you have people in a room, and that's okay. And that you need an awful lot of strategies to be effective in terms of helping children to learn. It's about knowing what the needs of your learners are, but it's also about knowing what the needs of the communities are. It's about knowing where parents are coming from in terms of their ideas about learning. And it's about trying to move students to see that an awful lot of the assumptions that they bring in about teaching need to be challenged. And I'm very happy at the end of the course in professional studies for them to return to some of the assumptions that they had and say, do you know what, I actually think that assumption was correct. I don't think there was anything wrong with my assumption. But I've now gathered evidence from a whole lot of areas, theory, research, practice, talking to others, that lead me now to reflect and to say, okay, here's why I think what I was thinking about teaching was actually valid. So we very much built on the work of Stephen Brookfield in terms of developing professional identity and the fact that you're not as a teacher just a set of skills. Your emotions, your values, you're a thinking person, you're a feeling person, but the work of a teacher is highly emotional work. It's highly emotional work. And effective teaching for us as a team, yes, it related to issues of social justice and related to notions of trying to encourage children to learn in a way that was valuable for them. It was, yes, about trying to get students to reflect on issues of power, whose curriculum, what is the set of competencies that you've got to meet, why that set of competencies, why do the General Teaching Council want you to say those are the competencies I meet and yet not others. It was about all of those things, but in what we do, it was about trying to produce for students in the professional studies seminars and lectures an introduction to a body of knowledge that for a lot of them was new, but also in the seminars a safe space that they could discuss, with one another, that they could do active reflection in these seminars. So for us, it was about Brookfield's notion of active reflection, developing yourself as a teacher. But it was also about Parker Palmer's work, Good Teaching Cannot Be Equated with Technique. And when you say that to students initially, they say, well, what the hell is it about then? Tell me what I need to know to be able to go into a classroom so that the children don't do what? Don't riot, aren't cheeky to me, because behaviour is the big issue for the students at the beginning. How do I manage a classroom? How do I control behaviour? Not why do children sometimes switch off from learning and act out? It's not the whys. It's, oh my God, if I don't control the behaviour, it's all going to go to hell in a handcart. That's a huge anxiety for them. And then, secondarily, are the children going to find what I teach them interesting, and how do I make it interesting? So they're very often equating effective teaching with techniques to make a subject interesting. Okay. And when we began to work on them initially in the early part of the professional studies course, it was, don't worry about that. Let's think about what you think good teaching is, what the good teacher is. What are your ideas about who you want to be as a teacher and how you want to connect with children psychologically, emotionally? Because the classroom, if you don't get the psychological and the emotional classroom environment correct, you're lessening the chances of effective teaching. So it was to get them to see teaching as psychological, as social, even environmental, even how you lay your classroom out matters. You know, can effective teaching go on in a classroom that's set out in rows? It might, but equally it might not. So it was to get them to think about all of those issues. So when we came to developing the course, we knew we wanted to base it a lot on reflective practice. But reflection doesn't just happen. And so the PGDE course is very time poor in terms of contact. So in the professional studies course, it was set up, they would have a lecture on whatever the subject happened to be, whether it was support for learning, whether it was psychology of learning, whatever it was. They would have a lecture, and then they would have a two-hour seminar per week. That was it, while they were in faculty. And so we thought, right, if we want the students to reflect, and we want them to connect with their own stories of teaching, what are the stories you're telling yourself as a teacher? Because an awful lot of it to begin with is based on a deficit model, particularly of children from, quote, areas of deprivation, unquote. Expectations of children's learning tended to be very low among students, and I have to say often among teachers, very low. Expectations of children in some areas was that they won't learn because, hey, they've got all this stuff happening in their lives. Because the parents don't value education. Well, really? How do you know this? An awful lot of stereotyping going on. And really to get the students to curriculum for excellence. Do you know what a title? And they take that on board. All must be excellent. Why? And what do you mean by excellence? So getting them to look at all these stories and narratives, but then to go beyond the narrative and to say, why do I have that narrative? Why is that the story I'm telling myself about what teaching is? Do I ever listen to the children when I go into a class and listen to what the children want about learning? No, because I'm teaching a curriculum. And I'm in a classroom where I have to evidence that the children are learning. How do I evidence it? I assess them. I do national tests. I do this, I do that. I test them. Do you ever just sit and have a conversation with children about what they want to learn and why and how they're connecting with the learning? Well, no. Why not? So all these stories. So when we came to thinking about assessing them, we knew we wanted them to... We were very much expected in a university to have a qualification, to have a grade. And if your course is a first-line gatekeeper of standards, professional standards, the public expect you to grade things. The government expect you to grade things. They expect a qualification to be predicated on grades. So we thought, right, okay, if we're going to have assessments and it's going to be a written assessment, we thought about a journal. We thought about getting them to write a reflective journal, and then we thought, at the minute we say we're going to grade that journal, it changes the narrative. And we thought, no, we don't want to do that, but we do want them to keep a reflective journal. And we're time poor, how are we going to do it? So what we did was we developed an online course. We decided to go for blended learning. And on the course, we explained and explored what reflective practice could be said to be, what professional identity could be said to be, how developing your own identity is important, why it's important. You need the theory, you need the research, you need the practice, but you need a sense of yourself as the person who teaches. And we explored on the online course forms of journaling. It doesn't have to be written. You can write a short story, you can draw a picture, you can write a poem. You can do whatever you want that's meaningful for you, that tells your narrative. And then about connecting narratives to research and connecting that to practice and placement, the idea of the critical incident, or however they wanted to frame this. And so what we did was we decided we wanted to assess transformation over time. So we had two assignments. The first shorter assignment came in December after one semester and was purely reflective writing. It was about think about something that was meaningful for you on practice that altered or shifted your view of what it means to be a teacher, and explore that, very much reflective. And then use the journal that you've been keeping to feed into that. And then for the second assignment, which was the 3,000 word assignment, at the end of the course, look back on your transformations as a learner and a teacher and what you've learned. And again, the reflective element, use elements of your first assignment, elements of your journal, and feed that in. And things you don't think of really causing anxiety to students. Use of the word I. You wouldn't believe it. No, you don't have to write in the third person. Yes, you can express an opinion. This is about you. Yes, you can talk about your feelings. Yes, you can talk about the fact. Because the whole notion of I must go into a school and I must be the competent, effective teacher from the word go. Well, no, you're not going to be. Not even by the end of this course are you going to be. Not even after 25 years as a teacher am I competent and effective all the time. And one of the things that they actually found quite powerful was when I used to, after classes, if something happened that made me think, I'd go and I'd write a reflective log on it and post it up for them. They'd go, you felt that? You didn't think that worked? That's amazing. And they really connected with that. But things like they would come to me as the course leader in a panic and say, I don't know how to write using the word I. I don't know how to, because if you do that, that's not academic. So the whole culture of what is academic writing, what has your first degree validated as academic writing, and I'm not being academic anymore. And this is a professional course, I'm a not made. All of these things, huge anxieties even in the seminars about expressing a feeling or saying I'm not sure about that or I can't see how that connects. And so the tutors on the course were absolutely marvelous, and they put in an awful lot of effort to allay these anxieties, worked really hard with students and got the students to see, okay, we're not pretending that the grade you get doesn't matter, because it does. But in trying to shift them away from a focus on the grade to how does this assignment help me learn? And is it helping me to learn? And is it helping me to think about what my role as a teacher should be for the students that I teach and for the communities that I'm going into work in? Getting them to see the bigger picture. Some students very much resisted it. You know, when we were talking about this, you literally had the body language. Why do I need to know about this? And you were talking about Lave and Wenger's work. I went to talk to the students. I did a lecture on, you know, connecting to working collegiately with others, but also not forgetting that it's not just the teachers you're working with, it's the parents, it's the community. And I remember, and one piece of feedback I got was, I do not need to be patronised by being told how to work with other people. And I thought, wow, oh dear, okay, that's fine. How do you get past that? The sense for some that this is something they cannot connect with. They're very much, some students felt very threatened by this notion that another student said to me, it's like Oprah Winfrey, I feel I've got to come in here and unburden. I'm going, that's really not what we're asking you to do. You know, that's not what we're asking you to do. But what the whole concept of reflection was met with hostility by some. Others really embraced it, and others wanted to embrace it and found it helpful, but really struggled with writing down this in a form that connected with experience. And we were not helped in the task by the fact that we had to put A to F grades and everything. That was the expectation. And we had to use the university's code of assessment. And if you look at the rubric for the code of assessment, what is a good piece of work? An exemplary range of evidence. Well, what is evidence of effective and transformative learning as a teacher? You know. If you read a lot of books, if you read a lot of peer-reviewed journals, that moves you from a B to an A. Well, no. So for us, the challenge of assessment, and I've put it down in what I've written, the challenges of assessment were having to make the balance between, it's a written task, but we want you to be able to learn from it. We want it to be a meaningful task for you, balanced with, We have the gatekeeping rule, we have the expectations for grading, the expectations for if you're going out to be a professional, then your learning ought to have been accredited as reaching a certain, you know, level. We had all of these challenges and all of these issues, and we've now moved to only having, we had changes imposed on us. I found it very difficult. And the reflective element's now all but gone, and we're back to one assignment. It happens in January, and we're asking the students to reflect. And they can't. After one teaching experience, they can't. So it's all moved back now to a very academic response. You know, this theorist says that, this theorist says that, this piece of research says that. In my classroom, I do. And it's become much more instrumental again. So there was really for us a big tension between the instrumental purpose of the assignments to get the credential, to say, yes, you have the professional knowledge and competence. And we didn't really want that. Given a choice, I wouldn't have graded. What I wanted was for it to be meaningful. Yeah. So there were all sorts of tensions for us.
Well, thank you. I'm going to open it up now. Do we have any questions, comments?
There's loads of things coming. The different elements, but I think going back to one of the things. Well, thanks, first of all, to hear from the three of you. One of the things Avril mentioned was about your observations. Teaching the BA community development within the University of Glasgow, and in recent times introduced assessed observations, because we had a real strong gut feeling that we wanted to be confident about not just the academic ability and the written work on practice, because it's a work-based degree and that students have to be working in the field at least 12 to 15 hours. And I just, I suppose I quite like the idea when you said that when you do the observation and preparation for it, you know, we would do a session plan, an urgent session plan, but actually you mentioned something about almost the kind of why are you doing that, and I feel that there's not a sense of that for our students. They do a session plan, and when you go and do the observation, you think, this feels like they're only doing it for the assessment, and it's not actually part of the overall work, you know, and, you know, the participants in the group are almost thinking, why are you, doing this session? It's just like being plummeted in, and I wondered, maybe you could tell us a bit more about it, because I think that's the extra column that I think we should ask our students, okay, so this session, but where does it fit in, and how does it connect to the values, and
that kind of model for practice observation comes from some work done at the University of York, Juliet Kaprowska and others at the social work department there. So if you look up York and you look up they've produced a video called Facts, Feelings and Feedback, which is a really good kind of training. So it was an HEA-funded piece of work, and we've used it as a framework because it assumes it takes the position that the student wants something from the observation, that they want information from it, they want to use it for their own learning and to gather feedback from it, and it's a cultural shift from someone's coming in to observe you and to decide if what you're doing is good enough or not. And it does kind of require those kind of relationships between observer and student. So an early negotiation about, you know, the student knowing not just what it is they're doing, but why are they doing it that way, what skills are they bringing to it, and what are they hoping to learn from the observation? What do they want feedback on from their observer? So, because it's a wonderful opportunity that most people in practice don't get much of the time. So that's part of the framing for students. And it's you get drift all the time that the observer, who would be doing your observations? Is it you?
Yeah.
Oh, great. But we have a whole group of observers who kind of come in and do this, they're trained to do it, and various ones kind of see it as a kind of very much a kind of assessment moment, and others are really kind of into it as a teaching and learning moment, and the latter is really what you're trying to achieve from it. So, and the debrief is, you know, kind of what did you get, what you want, you know, did you, how did that work, what happened, and so forth, rather than the how did I do, you know.
I don't think we're a million miles away, but there are definitely some things I think we need to think about. But we ask students to do a reflective account on the session, and they would tend to write about the overall session, and we're trying to say, think about that kind of critical incident or that moment of transformation and an experience. Yeah. We'll definitely look into that.
I used to have a portfolio to assess the qualification for our own staff in learning and teaching, and there were self-reflections on teaching sessions in that, which is typical, and I deliberately separated that from an element of the portfolio where somebody went in to watch them teach and said, you know, that was a completely done session sort of thing. Because I was trying to encourage them to use sessions where they tried something new that might have gone wrong. I used to say to them, you know, you're more likely to get good material for reflection on something that didn't work. And the good, confident teachers would do that. They'd use a session which hadn't necessarily gone well, and they'd really analyse it. The less confident people wouldn't put anything in the portfolio that didn't show themselves as being... I think it's a real problem. I think it helped a bit to say, have another session where somebody's coming and, you know, if you can't avoid having a judgment of competence, at least separate it from the set of things that you're self-evaluating.
You mentioned about reflective accounts and who would assess them or who reads them. and we introduced peer assessment of two of the in second and third years. Although, you know, I may think perhaps, you know, that all of the students should be involved in that, but just again, that's a sort of recent introduction, and feedback from students has been really positive. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, we are pressured for time, but the students seem to really value.
Yeah.
And there was a dual element, two aspects, sorry. One was that there was reflection on the stuff, the kind of things they were doing, but also getting feedback on their process of reflection as well, which was really, really helpful. Mm-hmm. So,
The first assignment that we had, which was reflective, although it was graded, its primary function was to give feedback on the reflective writing and the reflective process, and that's invaluable, I think. And you know that we encouraged them to work together in the seminars just before the assignments are due to talk about their assignments and how they want to share and how, you know, so that they're getting peer feedback on that. But the feedback on the reflective writing, I think, is really key to it. Yeah.
I think that's true. I mean, I'm an undergraduate module called Education in Practice, where actually we give them an opportunity to work with some colleges, and they go out and do sort of the science and the basement, but they also do stuff like the work that we do in the outreach section. So they will do mentoring, and they will do working on a campus-based event, and we set them almost reflective essay questions about the role of other adults in the classroom, some of those sort of ideas. But the biggest challenge, I think you're right, is getting them to understand that you can use I and how to write reflectively, and that, I think, is one of the biggest hurdles that we face. And we spend hours in lectures and seminars, you know, going over this process, and then still we get people that are just very scared to use it. And I think the students' reaction to this sort of approach to assessment, because I don't think this form of assessment is used enough in graduate learning to a large extent, is an easy opt out there for academics to say, well, obviously the students don't really take scripts, so it's something that I've struggled with quite a lot in some of my early work when I was doing personal development planning work at the university, and now we're looking at bringing some of that stuff back about, in the new climate, what does an undergraduate student paying £9,000 get, what makes them distinctive, what are we doing to assess almost what at the moment we're having a co-curricular, you know, that student experience on the side. And it's not enough to say, yes, I did a bit of volunteering and here, you know, I did this many hours, tick the box. It's about some sort of substantive reflection that we can say, well, actually, you haven't learned a whole lot on that. I know from personal experience, everything that I am as an employable individual came from other things outside of academic learning, and I've been able to learn to reflect on those processes, and you've become quite a reflective practitioner as a result. But I think developing that skill in students is almost as untangible as we felt being able to assess and develop this whole concept of entrepreneurship in students was a few years back. So I do think it's a new challenge going forward, that we do need to develop reflective practitioners in all students, particularly undergraduate, to even understand what they're getting from the student experience as part of the
I think in terms of assessment, I could be wrong, but thinking back on my time in the course, I think the students were completely unused to the assessor looking for a genuine response and actually being interested in what the students genuinely felt and genuinely experienced. You know, and for me, and I did keep saying to them, don't be afraid to give the genuine response. Don't be afraid to make this assignment meaningful for you. I think a lot of them really struggled with that concept.
I think you do have to fight sometimes university codes of practice.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wage a battle against the desire of our QA people to have consistency across the university of descriptors and grades and everything. Because what... It
makes it so much more difficult for the student if you're forced into a position where what they're being assessed on looks like a standard academic essay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas if you can break it down into, you know, shorter pieces, different modes of presenting this stuff, make a clear separation between the reflective stuff and the stuff where you have to cite the literature. I mean, my particular bugbear is assignments which require both kind of self-revelatory eye stuff and academic references. I mean, I'm not saying you can't do it, but you're setting such a hurdle for students.
Yeah.
So why do we... I understand why you do it, but it just makes it so much more difficult. It is difficult,
but I think it's important.
Yeah,
it's important.
Being a professional.
But you can't get, I mean, particularly on a PG, a short postgraduate qualification course, it's not long enough for them to learn how to do that.
Oh, it is. No, no, they can. They can do it. They'll struggle with it. Some can, some never will, but they'll struggle with it. But I don't think that's a reason not to try.
I just wouldn't get there in one jump. You know?
No, you can't get there in one jump.
We have a question there, and then we'll come back to
you. I'm just thinking about the
Yeah, absolutely.
It does.
And I did witness Jen trying to get e-portfolios in different places at the university. It's not all university staff are embracing the new.
But I totally agree. The technology should facilitate it.
Yes.
I mean, you know, there's minor things like you can't just take photographs of children in classrooms and put them in your... But, you know, there are ways... That is learning in itself. So.
Yeah.
I think the business of supporting students to join up their practice and knowledge is, as you say, it's a really complex task and one which, if we're committed to students being able to do it, we really ought to begin at the beginning and do it consistently.
Yes, right.
And we're about to enter the third year of our BA social work, which has practice at the core, where there are four points of assessment, all of which are integrated.
Mm-hmm.
And following each assessment point, they're all kind of differently structured, but all of them require students to demonstrate practice and do something analytical and knowledge-based with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's your nightmare, and ours sometimes. And as a response to feedback on each of those, students can add a third of their marks to that unit with a reflective piece, where they take the learning from the feedback from their own continued learning and reflection and say, this is now what I would write in addition to that task, which isn't just a what I think, what I learned. You know, it's not. It is critical, analytical, knowledge based, and they have to be in it. So we've got 8 points per year where students practice this in different formulae, and one of those is their exam where they actually have a video set of video and audio prompts as if they were in a situation of risk that they're having to assess. And that is very, that's visceral, is actually, is how that operates with them.
So I'm interested in what we can do is presenting academic tasks in a really different style as well. So that makes it very different, because I
You could do
it.
Yes.
So there's that bit of it as well.
Yeah. This isn't about service learning, but I've been promoting in our institution the patchwork text kind of curriculum model, mm-hmm. where the students are actually doing lots of short pieces, mm-hmm. some of which can be very academic, straightforward, you know, like a straightforward literature review, sharing short enough to share mm-hmm. with each other in the group, so they're getting the peer feedback. Mm-hmm. But the assessment is a synoptic, reflective, what have I learnt from this module, how have I met the learning outcomes of the module, maybe, but using those patches as evidence. Mm-hmm. So what you're assessing at the end is the student's own assessment of what they've learned with their evidence mm-hmm. from the patches. Mm-hmm. And I've been able to do that in physics and archaeology, mm-hmm. you know, really mm-hmm. kind of, and at level three, final year, so the marks count. Mm-hmm. So if they can do it, you know, it's possible to have mm-hmm. reflective writing in really, you know, traditional cognitive subjects.
I'm one of my responsibilities is overseeing and teaching English as a second language full degree certificate program. When I took it over, it was pretty black and white in terms of assessing, and I'm a big fan of reflective writing. And it was all letter grade, too, just when you talked about that issue, right? So I actually changed it, and I was really surprised the university actually accepted it. And we just did a credit, no credit, and I have a huge reflective part involved in it. I don't know that the powers-to-be actually knew what we were doing when we changed letter grade to credit, no credit, but I didn't care, because it certainly gave the
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I spend a lot of time talking to staff about how they can actually do things that they think they can't do.
That's right.
The regulations actually aren't as bad as they think.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I think too the universities say that that the university experience produces people who know how to learn. But I don't know how you do that unless people are aware that they're learning and how they learn.
And unless they're taught by people who are explicitly learning themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's that's something about the relationship, isn't it, that's really important, I think. And it's a challenge when you're assessing to be imperfect, to be not an expert, mm-hmm. to be a learner. Mm-hmm. But those things are really important in terms of building that space for learning. Mm-hmm.
I love the aha moment, you know, at the end of the experience when mm-hmm. using reflective writing, all this intimidation and anxiety that exists initially and gradually works about me.
But the challenge for me is how to preserve that in an environment that's pushing us towards students as customers and greater accountability. You know, if we're being challenged at every stage about the grades we give, there's got to be some protection within the, you know, you've got to be smarter, you've got to be clearer about what you do. And, I mean, maybe,
Can I say that one of the ways we protect our processes is through those multi-stakeholder moderation panels?
Yeah.
Because that way, if we have service users reading work and saying, no, that's a 70 and that's a 40. That one that's littered with hundreds of references is a 48.
Yeah.
And this one that has enough references but not loads is a 78.
Yeah.
And they've agreed that with us.
Yeah.
It's a, that's worth the effort, really.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, it's nice to see even over the waters that there's common issues, but also the commonalities in positive ways.
I just wanted to ask about, you talked about e-portfolios. I suppose I wanted to just ask about your view on what the portfolio does, and then from a, because we assess, and first year we assess the portfolio, and then the second year is part of that kind of formative process. Yeah. And it definitely changes the way students approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this feeling that it's something that's thrown together just about when the rather than it being a sort of meaningful tool that they can use as reflective practitioners, that allows them the space to think about the why and how they're doing things and so on.
I'm in a funny position because I've got myself associated in some people's minds with the e-portfolio movement, you know, an evangelical movement. Actually, I use the term very loosely. In technological terms, I use it loosely to refer to tools that do certain things, and I think blogs and wikis are probably more useful than all singing, all dancing e-portfolio systems for the functions that I want to use pedagogically with students. And it's the pedagogy that drives my interest. So, what I'm trying to encourage students to understand, which they need a bit of help understanding very often, is that recording things is worth the effort as they do it. And I don't know any way to convince them of that, but make them do it and then make them reflect on it, because then they see that it was valuable to have done it. The Stalinist in me comes out.
Yeah.
Well, of course, one of the issues that we had was we very much took the view that we were not going to look at the reflective journaling, whether they kept it electronically, whether they did it, whatever they did. It was to be theirs. At certain times, we would ask them to bring an example of writing or drawing or artwork or whatever it was into their seminars, if they wanted to share it with us. But the minute they know nobody's reading it, it's not assessed, no fault them, don't do it.
Do
and
it.
That came across very strongly in the assignments, that you were having these reflective incidents cobbled together.
Yeah.
And the statement, when I wrote this in my journal in December, and you thought, oh, come on, you know, I'm not that daft.
That's why I like blogs, actually, because they're date stamped.
Yeah,
uh-huh,
yeah. That's
one of the reasons I would actually push students to do it.
Yeah.
The only sort of weakness there is that not everybody will participate. And
that's right.
And you can't force people.
No.
Because, I mean, we had quite a good one in the MSc in Community Development, but we had two people in particular in that course who never contributed at all.
That's right, and you always get that.
It's a lost learning opportunity for them.
That's the thing about assessment, though. If you put a percentage that they have, 10% of your grade,
it gets
instrumental, but it gets
your
done.
Grade is how you respond to your peers' contributions. You have to watch your. I have to watch. I'll own this. My own tendencies to be Stalinist sometimes. Because I know so many strategies for inducing students to do the things I want them to do for learning, and because I know the strategies, I sometimes have to stop myself and think, actually, they are human beings who have a choice. But assessment strategies are powerful, so use them, but just keep an eye on your use of them, I think.
Even in our class, even when we're not doing stuff that sort of enforce people come to class and don't contribute to discussions, and that's the same as not filling in a reflective thing, because you lose out on the input.
But on the other hand, just because they're not contributing doesn't mean they're not learning, and doesn't mean they're not getting something from that.
No, but sometimes you need the evidence.
Yes, you do, and that gets into the whole area of the evidence and the evidencing of learning, and what forms are valuable for students and what forms are the institution, is the institution saying that is valuable, do you know? Yeah. And there's all these tensions about that.
I think that one thing would be valuable, even if everyone in the class didn't contribute to it, I came out on the wrong side there, because currently we have discussions where not everyone contributes, but we still get a lot of input.
Right.
So that was what I'm saying.
But you'll get the same in a blog, sorry.
But sometimes we have wiki tasks. Now, one of the things about wiki tasks is you can track what students do. We also have peer assessment associated with that, so the peers can comment on each other's contributions. Sometimes you find that the peers say these students have been very helpful face to face, even though it's not reflected in the blog, in the wiki statistics. So it's actually, you know, being quite smart, I think, in the recognition of the different ways in which you can use evidence without feeling like, you know, without ending up totally like Big Brother.
I think it's really hard though, because I think it's a fine line, isn't it, between trying to nurture students into understanding, like parenting, it's only different ways, helping them find their own path for the great good. And I think, I mean, I got so frustrated with it myself. I mean, my husband has gone back to university as a mature student. And in his first semester, he was expected to do just that.
Yeah.
Keep a blog, comment on advertising and branding things that he saw, and comment on what other people were blogging about. After that was no longer assessed, he's not even gone back to it once. And it's like, and I know it's very difficult because some people won't contribute to seminars and those sorts of things. And it is about learning styles, and some people will reflect not by writing or drawing or whatever, but just by sitting there and having a conversation over coffee with a fellow practitioner. And you can't capture and assess those sort of things, I understand that. But there are, you know, one of the things I hope maybe, and I should deny ever saying this in it outside of these people, I think, really, but maybe the price tag that comes with the new UK education system will urge students to try and get the most out of it, and will urge them to engage a little bit more. When they feel like they are paying £9,000, maybe they will engage in some of those formative things, because I find it really, really hard to do anything formative in any of the modules that I run, because so many of the students just are like, so this isn't great, this isn't a requirement, or okay, I have to do this. And they're not getting the right learning out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been guilty of it on various, you know, professional practices and assessments that I've done. You know, sort of, I haven't done that reflection for the last week, and I find it really frustrating how to engage that in the student, practitioner. And I do think it is something that at the university level we should be instilling in learners right from the word go, from the transition work that we do in wider participation, we do it in that sort of getting used to what university is about. We say to them, you should be a reflective learner. And then in some courses they get on it and it's not even expected of them at all.
Yeah.
I have the same reaction
to collaborative learning, because very often, you know, I feel like I'm forcing students to work in groups completely artificially.
Yeah.
But I also know that if I don't, some students won't discover until quite late on in the course that the most valuable resource is their fellow students.
Mm-hmm.
So at least I'm trying to give them an opportunity to find out that they can learn from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very fine line between forcing them to do something completely artificial and using a wiki is extra forcing, because they know I can monitor every move, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And knowing that if they don't, some, particularly, you know, 18-year-old female, well, actually male, 18-year-old unconfident students won't think of their peers as a rich learning resource. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to go on to the questions.
I'm just going to say something about peer assessment, because as soon as you bring the economics into it, you know, when you're paying for education, students just automatically think that if I'm paying for this, the only assessment I want is from the academics, you know.
Yeah.
And it changes the whole dynamic.
Yeah, it does.
We would probably all invest in this idea that we do already, at least I would incorporate, ensure that people saw the value of peer education, peer assessment, and saw that, you know, there was something meaningful in those contributions from their peers.
Yeah, I think really have to explain to them.
Can I just reflect on something that Paul said this morning in the keynote, which was that he was talking to the National Union of Students, and what I heard him say, I don't know if anybody else did, was about the way in which they position students as customers mm-hmm. or partners.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And I think what's really important to us is that we don't set up the dialogue of customers,
yes.
that we set up the dialogue of partners. Partnership. That's
Absolutely.
Really fundamental to success.
I'm just going to go first to you. Okay.
I suppose I just wanted to move on to this idea about you. You talked about your students working with lots of different people, and this idea our students are working with communities, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're referred to as this idea of customers. That's an aside, but whatever way we ask students to reflect on the things that they're doing, whether it's through blogs or reflecting accounts or whatever, I think we have to hold on to the idea that we're talking about real people,
mm-hmm.
primary, secondary,
mm-hmm.
children, families, mm-hmm. communities we work
yeah.
with. So we have to have a really sort of concrete and sound way of making sure that our students are doing the right things and doing things right, and that they're not damaging people,
mm-hmm.
and that
yeah.
if
mm-hmm.
I think we're introducing that we're actually going to push people to, you must submit a reflective thing by this particular time, and to see this, that they're going in the right direction, and or that you think, oh my goodness, there are some checks in place that have been damaged, maybe damaged people are not even more damaged.
Yeah. But that's why the service user and carer movement and participation in social work education is so vital,
yeah.
because I've learned more from those consultants, if you like, those participants and partners in our programme, than from anybody else about what's good enough practice. So,
yeah. I think that leads on to what I was going to say. I think for me, in my course, the whole reflective thing is about me being a better practitioner. And actually, it can't just be about when I'm a student being a reflective person. So the whole point of instilling these disciplines, I guess, into students is that when you become a practitioner and you leave the university,
you don't
these
stop
things
doing
will
it.
Carry on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, it's an issue of accountability of how am I as a practitioner, how would I get my accountability beyond university,
mm-hmm.
and how do I set up those networks of peer support in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so my motivation for being that sort of student is that I want to be that sort of practitioner, and
yes.
not
yeah.
necessarily that I'm getting paid
yeah.
for it.
Yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
Excellent. I want to thank everybody for coming, and especially our panelists.